the next item, please.
427, accept the City of Portland and Multnomah County Climate Action Plan 2017 Progress Report.
Very good. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor, City Council. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So we're here to provide you with an update on the Climate Action Plan, and a lot has been happening in the past 2 years, and with two new members on the City Council, we thought it would be a good idea to give you a little bit of a review. As a reminder, from this slide here, you can see soon. We've been at this for a really long time. So we developed the first Climate Action Plan in 1993, and Commissioners Lindbergh and Earl Blumenauer were sitting in your chairs at that time. They were champions. And the picture on the left is the actual floppy disk that I used to write the original plan on.
Susan, what chairs did they sit in?
I believe it was.
So they're here?
It was that one right there. Good. We did.
The same chair?
Well, okay. But
I'll continue to make things up, don't worry. Okay. So we did an update in 2001 under Commissioner Saltzman, another update in 2009, and then a whole new plan in 2015. The new plan has all the traditional sections of energy efficiency, renewable energy, looking at more efficient transportation and more. But the new plan also includes sections on climate adaptation and preparation. What do we do when things start to change? And a special focus on ensuring equity, that it's woven throughout the plan and that all Portlanders have an opportunity to benefit from the impacts of the plan. So this plan recently won the C40 recognition as the best climate action plan in the world, not something that most people care about right now, but for us and people who are doing the work, it's quite an honor, and the work, a lot of it goes to thanks to Michael and his team. So what's happened since then? A lot of great work has happened, and it's not just been a plan that's sitting on a shelf somewhere. It's being implemented by government, by businesses, by individual residents in the way that they live their everyday lives. So total carbon emissions are now down 21% since we began tracking back in 1990. At the same time, total emissions for the entire U.S. are up 8%, so we're clearly heading in a different direction. Our local and statewide and utility policies and actions and investments have really made a difference. Some people, when you look at this slide, initially said, well, the reason the emissions went down is because of the recession. So we began to really pick the numbers apart and look at all of the indicators related to jobs and population and how did those interact with emissions. And what we found is that from 1990 to 2014, population increased by 33%, jobs increased by 25%, but total emissions are down 21%. So more people, more jobs, but significantly fewer emissions. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The things that you would normally think of, energy efficiency, both in new construction and making improvements in things that are already built, more solar, more wind energy, less coal in terms of generation of electricity, more people getting out of their cars, and all of our cars becoming more efficient. So the list kind of goes on, but even with this good news, I think we should continue to be very, very humble because we only look really good because the bar is so low for the rest of the United States and really for many parts of the world. So when you look, next one, yeah, thanks. When you look at where we need to go, it's an 80% reduction by 2050. You realize that we have an enormous amount of work ahead of us to reach our goal. The Climate Action Plan has a very specific roadmap with very specific actions, and though it is difficult, we very much believe that it is very doable. And not only doable, but we believe that it's possible to save a lot of money along the way for business, for government, for residents. And we've shown that not only does it save money, but it will also very much be an opportunity for people to make a lot of money by selling sustainable products and technologies and services that we've begun to use here and are now selling to the rest of the world. And when Kimberly Branham comes up, she'll talk probably a little bit about some of the businesses that are making and selling products. The green economy sector now includes in the metro area 47,000 jobs. It's responsible for $750 million in exports to Canada, to Mexico, Japan, China, and other places, and $10 billion in domestic sales. So this is a significant part of our economy now. In the beginning, we were doing this to do the right thing here in Portland, and it's grown into an economic sector that is part of the engine, really, for Portland. So even if some people in D.C. don't believe that it's real, I think we've once again got local proof that prosperity and environmental quality really do go hand in hand. So I just want to thank all of you who are sitting in these chairs now. It's been a long road, and we need to continue this work. I'm very happy to have the strong support of the mayor in terms of climate change being an issue that you really care about and that you've all really cared about. And I'm going to turn it over to Michael to give you some highlights of some of the things that have been going on the past 2 years. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Mayor and Commissioners, I'm Michael Armstrong with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. Before I dive into the highlights, I want to make sure you are all aware that a key engine behind all of our climate planning work is my colleague Michelle Krim, who can't be here this afternoon. I want you to know how much credit she deserves, and I want her to know that we are thinking of her, even though she can't be with us today, and she's really a tremendous part of our climate planning work. So the slide in front of you gives the overall picture. You know, the 2015 Climate Action Plan includes these 171 actions at a really broad strokes level. A lot is on track. So by and large, we are moving forward with the big things that Council laid out for us to take on in 2015. I will share a couple of quick highlights and then point to a few things that we still really need to dig into if we're going to make progress on. So over the last few years, and I'll go through these pretty quickly, but there's a long list of big initiatives that have come through City Council. A couple years ago, we had a requirement come to Council that was to ensure that large commercial buildings benchmark their energy use and compare themselves to national averages. The second year of reports came into us last week, so going down to buildings 20,000 square feet and up, by and large, they are complying and learning things through that process. And like so much of the climate work we do, this happens in partnership with Portland General Electric, with PacifiCorp, Northwest Natural, the Energy Trust of Oregon. Everybody's got a part to play to make this commercial energy performance benchmarking effort succeed. Later this year, we'll have the first report on how those buildings are doing. So that will become public this fall. Late last year, you know, first you had done commercial energy performance. Late last year, we brought to you a proposal around single-family homes so that when people buy homes or when they're looking at homes for sale, they have the ability to compare the expected energy use across a different range of houses. This proposal will now take effect January 1st of 2018. So we are busily working to get all the rules in place, make sure that the assessors who can provide these scores are trained, available, that all of the mechanics of the system are ready to go. We're making progress on that. You'll see some pieces come through Council that need your consideration over the next few months, but this is moving forward as well. So this should begin to make a difference in helping consumers see the impacts and kind of variation across different houses of how well they perform on energy. We're also trying to put tools in place to help building owners, building managers who want to improve the energy performance of their buildings. There's a new program that was developed together by Multnomah County and the Portland Development Commission, again in partnership with others, that makes financing readily available to commercial building owners who need access to capital in order to make the improvements. Then they're able to pay it back through an arrangement that involves the property tax levy. So this program is now in place. We're starting to get some buildings go through it. We want the performance. We also want to have the tools that make it easy for building owners to do this. Another major policy that came through City Council in actually each of the last 2 years was around restricting the expansion of large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure. The zoning code that's now in place prevents adding large-scale new tanks right along the river where they present all kinds of hazards in addition to steering our economy toward fossil fuels. So that's now in place, and that is quite a milestone both regionally and nationally. Buildings are one very large chunk of our carbon emissions. The other very large chunk is transportation. I'm pleased that Leah Treat is here from the Bureau of Transportation, and she'll be able to share her observations with you shortly. BikeShare, obviously launched recently, provides a new affordable opportunity to get around town, and I think we're seeing good numbers for usage of that, and hopefully that's a system that can expand over time to serve more parts of the community. Housing, another important piece of this. You're all extremely familiar with these details. The legislature finally, upon long work by you and your colleagues, removed the prohibition against inclusionary housing at the local level. You were able to move forward last year with new requirements. Those will now begin to take effect and will help us steer and make sure that affordable housing happens where it's in proximity to neighborhoods that are walkable, that are well connected by transit and other options. So this, too, is an important part of how we grow in ways that reduce carbon emissions but also provide quality of life and affordability for all of our residents. The comprehensive plan is now in place. These are the foundations that often don't even get a mention in climate action plans, but they're fundamental to our policies going forward. We don't get to our long-term carbon reduction goals if we're not successful at integrating land use and transportation planning. It's something Portland has done for decades now, better than almost any city anywhere, and it continues to be fundamental to our work going forward. So this is really key. We also have brand new initiatives, things that didn't exist anywhere and still don't exist anywhere except in Portland. Last year, City Council put in place a new requirement that a house that is more than 100 years old that is slated for demolition must be taken apart by hand and the valuable pieces of that house salvaged for reuse. And so this has got a whole range of benefits from reusing materials so that we're not having to source virgin materials as those are reused, to improving the neighborhood air quality when instead of houses being bulldozed in a cloud of dust, if we're lucky, and all sorts of other pollutants if we're not, instead of that cloud of dust, you get something that's taken apart by hand much more carefully, much more safely. So this this requirement's been in place almost 6 months now. We actually will be back to you next month with an update on how that's going and some possible tweaks to that program. No climate plan presentation is complete without featuring the Tillicum Crossing. This is such a fantastic, you know, both symbol and you know, functional piece of infrastructure that shows where we need to go, and because it's there, it shows where we are going. So the largest car-free bridge in North America, it's both carrying people in ways that help meet our climate goals. It's also kind of future-proofed in terms of being built to withstand the expectation that we're going to have more varied river levels in the future. As we get more intense rain events, those coincide with higher sea levels and the tidal influence on the Willamette. We need to be prepared. This bridge was engineered to be prepared for that. So really fantastic in many, many respects. Many programs that we roll out are oriented around putting resources in the hands of our residents and businesses so they can save money at home in their businesses. The Fix-It fairs are one example of that. This is a photo from one of the three fairs that we run each year. We get about 1,500 residents. We try to hold these fairs where they're accessible to communities that historically have not had access to resources. And so that's helping provide both information and access to incentives around energy efficiency, but also water conservation, transportation options, a whole host of home-based efficiency opportunities for residents. A couple more here. Recycling and composting. We will also be back to you next month with a proposal for solid waste rates going forward. This composting program that allows us to put our food in with our yard debris, and that's now picked up weekly, garbage picked up every other week. That program and policy change took effect in 2011, so 5 years in now. The rates that we bring back to you to recommend for next year will be lower than the rates at the time this program took effect in 2011. And so, you know, that's because residents are doing a fantastic job. They are using the program. The more food we get out of the garbage and into the compost, the the lower the rates go. And the haulers have really been tremendous partners in this. They find efficiencies. Those then flow back into lower rates for residents. So this change has helped us achieve a recycling rate of on the order of 65% between recycling and composting. It's among the highest in the country. That's something that, you know, each of us has the opportunity to do at home and at work. So we're seeing good results there. In the community, in the long run, we don't get this done without community partners, and there are so many all around the city. This is the Malden Court Community Orchard in Lentz. This used to be or was first acquired by the Bureau of Environmental Services and was able to be converted into a community orchard through long work by multiple city bureaus, by really dedicated community participants, by neighbors, by families. And this orchard had its grand opening last year, 150 people out there in the pouring rain to celebrate something really terrific. So fantastic use of resources where we have them, getting them in the hands of people who can use them. So we just heard from the Intertwine Alliance. You know, I don't need to reiterate all of the tremendous work that's gone on there. BES, Parks, many, many community partners. Intertwine is chief among them. You know, we've gotten 200 acres cleared of invasive species, working at adding to the tree canopy across the city, planting trees at schools, involving 700 students and teachers. Lots of great work. This serves us well, both for absorbing carbon out of the air, carbon dioxide, but also helping cool the city, manage our rainfall, manage our stormwater, clean the water as it flows. So really tremendous benefits all around from bringing nature into the city. One of those benefits is indeed helping keep the city cool. We are already seeing hotter heat waves in the summer. We are trying to improve our understanding of where our most vulnerable residents live. So people who don't have access to air conditioning, people who have higher rates of asthma, people who may not be able to get to or be comfortable going to a library or another place where you have access to air conditioning. So we're measuring that, and this is a very nice partnership with Portland State University, which is doing some really groundbreaking national research, you know, taking measurements as you move, you know, foot by foot, meter by meter across the city to understand what the conditions of development are that lead to hot spots and cool spots, so that as we continue to develop, we can be designing that development to make sure that the neighborhoods stay cool. So this is great work. This will take a long time to achieve, but as we go, we need to be making the right decisions. So PSU has been a great partner on this. Another change of the last 2 years, there is now a 10-cent local gas tax. You know, anyone who pays attention to transportation finance knows that we are using less gasoline in Portland than we did even 20 years ago, despite all the population growth. It's a product of all of these efforts to help make it easy to get around the city without relying on the car. Good for carbon, it's good for air quality, it's good for public health, it's good for pocketbooks, it's bad for revenue to maintain that same transportation system. This obviously was an important step in the right direction. There's clearly more work to be done for us to both maintain our system and make the investments we need for this to be a functional transportation system for everyone. A couple notes on the city's own operations. You know, walking the talk is a critical piece of this. We continue to make investments in almost every single bureau that are reducing our energy use, improving our on-site renewable power generation. That's solar, electricity from biogas at the wastewater treatment plant. This very exciting new project that's underway to use biogas in the wastewater treatment plant as a transportation fuel. Bureau of Environmental Services is, you know, again, really pioneering a fantastic effort there. We also have the very nuts and bolts changes like converting all the streetlights to LED bulbs, the largest energy efficiency project in the city's history. This is really good for the taxpayers. It's really good for carbon emissions. So really good, steady progress by almost all city bureaus. You see it also in fleet. City fleet now has 130, or across all city vehicles, we have 130 electric vehicles. Some of those plug-in hybrids, more than half of them fully battery electric vehicles. We have a new electric vehicle strategy that was adopted at the end of 2016. A big focus of that is making sure we have access to charging throughout the city. and particularly in multifamily properties where, you know, if you own your own house and you've got a garage, it's pretty clear what your option is to charge. If you're a renter or you don't have or live in a multifamily property, it's not obvious what your options are. That's a barrier. We need to address it. So we're working on that. Okay, and then finally, you know, all this stuff happens in partnership. I spent a long time talking about partnerships. One in particular I want to note is work we've done together with Portland State University, where PSU put its own resources toward funding interns to work with community-based organizations in Portland who are working to carry out their priorities from within the Climate Action Plan. So PSU funded 10 interns with different organizations around the city as a cohort, so they were able to support them. Really fantastic piece of a larger partnership between the city and PSU around climate action. So great work there. We are also working very closely with the Cully neighborhood, which is doing a community energy action plan, VOS, which is doing a climate and environmental justice plan, the Portland African American Leadership Forum, also doing an environmental justice and climate action plan. We want to support those community efforts. They're leading them. We want to support in any way we can. So exciting work around community action. Okay, there are a couple of challenges, and some of these have to do with detailed policy things, like in Oregon we have a statewide building code. The energy performance in it has not been strengthened in a number of years now. We used to be a leader in this area. We have fallen well behind California, Washington, other states. We need the state to move forward on strengthening the building code. That's something we can express to them, and we are expressing to them. One area where we've got challenges, I mentioned funding for transportation improvements. That's a long-term challenge. We need to keep working on that. And then certainly we have challenges in terms of new direction coming out of the federal government. And some of that is kind of really grand energy policy things. There's been a lot of attention to things like the Clean Power Plan. The things that I think we'll see affect us locally are maybe less visible in the big conversations, but they're things like the feds either reversing or certainly not advancing things like appliance efficiency standards. They actually end up making an enormous difference to household budgets, to business expenses. Mm-hmm. Things like fuel efficiency standards for vehicles, those are very likely to be relaxed. That's just bad for our economy as well as bad for our carbon emissions. And even things like the Energy Star label that helps people identify what's an efficient appliance, that entire program is proposed for elimination in at least the initial budget proposal. So those could be really significant challenges for us going forward. We'll see how they play out. In terms of next steps, truly we only get this done if we continue to work more closely than ever with the county, with PDC, with PBOT, Portland State, community organizations. We want to work closely with the utilities, which are really taking some great steps forward in terms of supporting state legislation to continue to add renewables to their power portfolio. We need that trend to continue and, if anything, to accelerate. So we want to work with them on that. We need to deliver on our kind of integrated goals of climate, of equity, of affordability in big development projects like the Broadway Corridor, the area surrounding the post office redevelopment, even in our own Portland building reconstruction, making sure we are doing what we can as we can. So with that, I've mentioned a couple things that will come back to council, so you'll see more on that soon. We do have a number of our community partners here with us today that we'd like to invite to give you a brief testimony as well. And if I think we're happy to answer questions now or perhaps hear from them.
Why don't we hear from them, and then we'll hold questions for the end.
Great. Okay.
Very good.
So I believe, and I didn't get to see Chair Kafoury here. Is anyone? All right, she may not be here. Okay, so.
When she gets here.
Very good.
I hope she'll join us. So we have Kimberly Branham with PDC, Leah Treat with PBOT, and then Vivian Satterfield with OPAL, and Robert Liberty with Portland State University. Maybe they can come up in sequence. Thank you. Very good.
bring your own chair.
Good problem solving, baby. Nicely done. Good afternoon.
Yeah, sure. Great. Good afternoon. Again, Leah Treat, Portland Bureau of Transportation. So the Climate Action Plan is a multi-bureau effort, as you've heard, not only to plan but also on implementation. And so we're pleased to have the opportunity to join BPS, PDC, and community partners talking about our efforts and successes and work ahead. So for transportation, reducing carbon emissions means making it safe and convenient to walk, bike, and take transit. And it also means that we need to be working to reduce our own impact on the infrastructure system. So, for example, the LED retrofits that Michael mentioned are an important component that we are contributing. So along with the LED conversions, also just bookmark that say that the savings that we have generated from converting the LEDs citywide have been significant enough that we have been able to take those savings and reinvest it into doing more of LED conversions. So it wasn't originally conceived that we were going to be able to do the ornamental lights in the central city, and we've saved enough money that we're now converting those too. So we're continuing to reinvest in reducing our impact. But we've also made significant investments in pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure since 2012. We've invested $46 million over the past several years. We've installed 7 miles of new sidewalks in East Portland. We've built 80 miles of neighborhood greenways, and we have another 43 miles funded. We've built 20 miles of buffered bicycle lanes, and we have another 10 miles funded. And we've built 3.5 miles of protected bicycle lanes, not including Better NATO. And we have another 8 miles funded. And we also are working on the development of a Portland-specific protected bicycle lane design guide that's going to facilitate faster development of cycle tracks in the future. In 2015, we completed 32 projects to improve crossings in our bike network, and we also have completed the streetcar loop, and we have seen growing ridership on our streetcar system. And, of course, as Michael pointed out, the Tillicum Crossing, we partnered significantly on the financial investment there. We also are investing money in Safe Routes to School. Safe Routes to School has increased walking and biking to Portland schools by 35% since 2006. The participating schools in our system have a school trip commute rate of 43% active trips to school, which is well above the national average. And Michael also mentioned BikeTown, our bike share system that we launched in July of 2016. Last year, 38,000 people rode BikeTown, taking 162,000 trips. Our survey data that we have collected shows that 26% of users have reported using an auto less, and that 62% of our local users are reporting biking more since joining the program. So these investments are paying off, and we're making progress on making it easier for people to get around without relying on a car. And we're seeing an increasing percentage of people taking trips by walking, biking, or rolling, and also in transit. And we're also seeing the numbers of miles driven per person declining, and this is happening while our population is growing. We also are seeing this in our carbon numbers, too. Our transportation emissions are now 5% below the 1990 levels and 14% below peak levels in 2002. But there's still more work ahead. We have a lot of work to make transit more convenient, a lot of work for walking and bicycling to be safe and convenient. We still need more sidewalks, we need safer bicycling routes, and we really need to strengthen our partnership with TriMet so we can get expansion of transit service. And we know that safe streets are what will incentivize people to choose low-carbon ways of getting around. So we need to provide safe streets for everyone. That's streets where all Portlanders, from the oldest to the youngest, including all physical abilities, can move safely. And we need to protect the most vulnerable and teach one another to live and travel together. And I believe education and awareness are a critical component of that as well. And we also need to be enforcing safe behaviors on our streets. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. I'm Kimberly Branham, Executive Director at the Portland Development Commission. And so it's really a great opportunity to be here today to talk about the partnership. And I'd like to begin by appreciating the collaborative approach that Susan and her team, Michael and Michelle, consistently show. We feel like it is true partnership and that there's within that partnership a lot of innovation that comes through that. So we appreciate that consistent approach. As Susan mentioned, at a time when cities around the world are faced with this sort of either-or of prioritizing economic growth or the environment, Portland has really shown that lowering carbon and growing the economy are not mutually exclusive. In fact, the part of the story that is often not told is that for Portland, our progressive climate policies are inextricably linked to our economic growth. PDC has been working with the Mayor's Office and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to participate in a C40 Climate Leadership Group data pilot with New York City, Vancouver, BC, London, Singapore, Oslo, and Copenhagen to quantify our respective low-carbon economies. And the findings revealed through this pilot are unequivocally positive for Portland. What they found is that the low-carbon sector is a large and globally competitive employer. It's well-balanced across subsectors within our economy and is a net exporter. So the analysis clearly shows that there really is no either-or choice when it comes to climate policy and the economy. Portland's climate leadership has created one of its largest sectors. We anticipate, it looks as though almost 10% of our city's economy is related to our climate leadership. So you have businesses like Columbia Green, who is a green roof technology producer, Vestas, which has its North American headquarters here and is one of the largest producers of wind energy. You have urban mobility technology solutions such as Moovil, which just opened up its new headquarters in Old Town Chinatown. These businesses really focus on creating solutions from urban mobility through alternative energy and are creating fabulous living wage jobs. So much of our economic development work concentrates on the growth and success of this sector. In the past few years, PDC We Build Green Cities partnership has established local Portland firms as the go-to experts in high-performance, energy-efficient development. One example is the success of Kashiwanoha Smart City near Tokyo, which is Japan's first LEED ND Platinum project, which relied on a team of Portland companies for its master planning process, including woman-owned Place Studio and ZGF. On a local level, we're really proud of our recent launch of Property Fit program, which was mentioned before, and our support of Drive Oregon and the electric vehicle industry here. We've also established within PDC a corporate connections initiative in partnership with Oregon Best, which promotes local innovators and energy technology and connects them to corporate investors. So energy storage systems, for example, received investment from a Canadian VC firm just at the last year event. We're working on many fronts to help the city achieve its climate action goals, and we are ever mindful of the importance of ensuring that all of Portland's residents and communities benefit from this economic expansion. So, for example, the prime contractors that are performing on the Property Fit program must hold the federal designation of being a DBE certified or minority and women certified firm. So we look forward to our continued effort with each of you and our local partners on climate action that has equity and economic benefits at its core. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Vivian Summerfield, I'm the Deputy Director of.
Is that
great to be here today? I help serve as a member of the Climate Action Plan.
Press a green button.
Group.
Yeah.
Is it not on?
There
we go. Yes, I can start over. Hi, good afternoon. I'm Vivian Satterfield. I'm the Deputy Director of Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. And I served as a member of the Climate Action Plan Equity Work Group, actually starting in summer of 2013. So a lot of work has gone into this. Some of the groups that I worked alongside in that equity work group included Apano, my colleagues at the Coalition of Communities of Color, Wisdom of the Elders, the now folded Upstream Public Health, but now revived again. And I think there may be another group as well. And I'm sorry if I've forgotten who they are specifically, because 2013 was a few years ago. So there's been a lot of work by a lot of dedicated individuals since that time. And so this progress report is really just an important check-in to keep us accountable to the goals that we set from that time. And I especially want to call out some of the great staff who really helped shepherd a lot of the actions through and really helped build my understanding around actionable items that we could include in the Climate Action Plan. Especially want to call out Desiree Williams-Raji, Michelle Krim, and other staff who really helped build our capacity in this realm and really responded to our questions when we wanted to actually perform some of that processes. So this plan, as you know, is really ambitious, but I think it's one that we recognize must be achieved, especially in this political time and moment. So our region has shown that we can plan for a vision of this equitable, healthful future. We've committed in this plan to achieve a future in which, echoing Director of PDC here, the future in which economic growth and people's health and the health of our environment are not mutually exclusive. So the plan must be activated with leadership, yes, from you all in this council and from our elected leaders at the county. And I'm especially excited about the announcement that our state senator, Merkley, had today about his 100 by 50 plan and also the impending city and county resolution as well. I think these are really important action items that are coming down. I also want to recognize that leadership also needs to come from our communities. So, in fact, we've already have tremendous leadership in our communities when it comes to climate issues. Frontline communities have long asserted that food security, transportation access, immigration, housing security, and police militarism are all climate justice issues. So there's an opportunity here to take the lead from these communities. And I'm a perpetual organizer, so of course I brought flyers. We're this Saturday. We're rallying and marching as a part of the People's Climate Movement. And we're really calling for a just transition from an extractive, exploitative economy to that of a regenerative one. We're also very fortunate to currently have the support and endorsement of the Bureau of Planning Sustainability for this march as well. I have to get on a soapbox because I have the microphone. Climate change is only a symptom of a much deeper crisis that is happening worldwide. The ecological crisis, economic crisis, and the crisis of empire. And these crises come from a current dominant economy, and it's a system that only works for a few, which relies on exploitation, extraction of resources, and a concentration of wealth and power. We must create a system that works for everyone, based on cooperation, regenerative processes, and governed by deep democracy. So we have and will continue to show up to defend the content of this plan through its actual adoption. And our communities, and ones that OPAL works with very closely, are immigrants, refugees, low-income folks, people of color, youth, elders, and those with disabilities. We're currently being targeted in this day and age, and we really have the most at stake. But frontline communities must be engaged in the development and implementation of climate change-related policies first. The burden should not be placed on community groups to provide the research and best practices and policy precedents for these measures. If we're going to meet these lofty goals as set forth in the Climate Action Plan, we must add capacity in that arena. So in order to meet many of the goals that are being outlined, we must recognize that the investment must be significant and must be upfront. And that's going to cost money. It's real money. So we should expect to see dedicated resources in our city budget that really prioritizes the actions that are in this plan. We should expect to see these resources being made first and available first for organizing, for education, and for engagement of our communities. So I think this is a really critical time to be looking both at the Climate Action Plan and also looking, of course, in discussing the city budget priorities. We'll be hoping to engage and hopefully see you all on Saturday as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for your hard work.
Good afternoon. I'm Robert Liberty. I'm the director of the Institute for Sustainable Solutions at Portland State University. President Vivol sends his regrets that he couldn't be here today to testify on behalf of PSU. He's in Japan, studying, among other things, preparation for and recovery from major subduction earthquakes. I'm here to applaud and celebrate your progress so far in implementing a very ambitious and multi-sided climate action plan, and encourage you to maintain that momentum and leadership. It's very important nationally for us to do so in the face of very retrograde policies at the national government level. Policies, by the way, which I think will not endure for very long, And in the meantime, it's up to communities like Portland to demonstrate leadership, innovation, and the kind of partnerships that you are seeing celebrated today. I think there are grounds for optimism for even achieving your more ambitious goals, including one that you'll be considering soon on having purely renewable energy sources. Why do I think that? Well, because technological change is making solar and wind power competitive with fossil fuels in many parts of the United States right now. And battery storage, which is critical for things for places are going to be dependent on intermittent renewable energy sources, is going to rapidly approach a place that it also makes it competitive. So we have opportunities in this region both because of a legacy of hydropower and a commitment to policy change around energy conservation renewables to implement a policy that I think would have been inconceivable a few years ago. PSU has been and wants to continue to be a partner with you on the Climate Action Plan, both its strengthening and its implementation. Our university has its own Climate Action Plan, and we have our own update. And it may or may not be familiar to you, but one of the sets of objectives in the Climate Action Plan is to have 80% of total energy from local renewable sources by 2030 and to have carbon neutrality by 2040. That is not going to be easy for us. We have a legacy of older buildings, but we do think it is achievable. That's one aspect of our commitment to you as a partner, which is as a large institution, with the largest employers in the city. But the second is as a research institution, as a place that has as its motto, "Let knowledge serve the city." We have 120 faculty members affiliated with the Institute for Sustainable Solutions. Their work is on practical, applied solutions to the challenges of sustainability, and front and center is climate change. We have a multiplicity of projects underway with your city bureaus, certainly BPS, but also BES, and I think transportation, parks, many others. And we will expect those to grow over the coming years, and that your contribution actually enriches the scholarship and student experience at the university. So it's beneficial all around, and it reinforces what I think is one of the defining characteristics of our region and our city, and one of our real riches, which are the citizens who are active, engaged, and knowledgeable, no matter what their background is. It is an amazing number of people here who have a depth of knowledge about these policy issues and how to be implemented. And I want to mention that it's been a pleasure to begin working with Commissioner Udaly around an accessory dwelling unit project, which is going like gangbusters, I have to say. I feel like I'm supposed to be facilitating, mostly running behind this 30 or 40 people that span the spectrum from architects to bankers to developers and people working for advocacy for seniors and affordable housing. So you'll hear more about that in the future. But I want to celebrate what you've accomplished and urge you on, and know that you'll have a partner with you all the way through at Portland State University. Thank you.
Thank you. Robert, can I just make one observation? I'm finishing a book called Lion of the Senate that someone recommended I read as an antidote to the times we live in. And the important part about this book is it covers the period from the passage of the Contract with America and the Republican takeover in the House, and then looks forward 2 years. And it was just after the 1994 election that Ted Kennedy decided he wanted to focus on lifting the minimum wage and expanding health care for all Americans. And the conventional wisdom was that with the House and the Senate in the having gone flipped, and with a sea change in politics, that wasn't possible. 2 years later, he got an increase in the minimum wage, and he got a major reform of health care. So to your point that some of the headwinds we're seeing may be temporary, I suggest this book, Lion of the Senate, as a kind of a reassuring reminder that there's nothing inevitable about the hand that history deals you.
It's great to have a lion in the Senate instead of lion in the Senate, which we also have.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. So why don't we see if there's any public testimony before we go to council discussion. Is there anyone signed up?
We have one person, Bob Proctor.
Very good. Come on up, sir. Thank you.
I I was hoping for some more targets here. There's only me here.
No worries.
Could you press that gray button?
Is the green light on there?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, good. If you could just state your name for the record.
Oh, there it is. On,
there you go.
On brighter.
My name is Robert Proctor. Live in Southeast Portland. And before I give my comments, I think I need to preface it from where I'm coming from. I started working on solar energy in the late 70s, and I was working on my master's at Purdue. My doctorate research was in a different subject matter, but on conservation. I worked for Bonneville Power for 20 years. First thing I did was do the economic analysis of what is now the energy component of the building code in the four Northwest states. I went into teaching, went back to the Public Utility Commission here in the state, working on under federal money on smart grid policy for Oregon and also demand response policy. So I think that's kind of important because of what I'm going to say. Okay. With regard to the section in the document on page 3, SB 1547 does not mandate coal plant closure. You will not find anything in that statute which requires either PGE or PacifiCorp to close any of their coal plants. Now, we know that Boardman would be closing theirs, but that was negotiated in 2010. And so they were going to close that, or they were going to switch to biomass. And they have not made a decision on that yet. Let me just say, I'm an independent energy economist, and I'm not looking for any money. PGE is proposing some additional renewables as a result of 1547. PacifiCorp plants are meeting the higher RPS with renewable energy certificates. Now, renewable energy certificates are these things that have value that people buy and sell, but they're not electrons from renewable energy necessarily in this region, let alone this state, let alone this city. So for example, you can buy a REC from a Virginia utility who has a wind farm and use that here to meet your renewables requirement under state statute. That's the implication of that. PacifiCorp primarily is not going to be building very much in the way of renewables in Oregon, in Portland, in Multnomah County to meet its requirements under 1547. As of right now. I just had a journal article published last month that goes into 1547 and its limitations and what it doesn't do. And, for example...
Excuse me, Carlos, since we only have one person signed up, why don't we give him two more minutes to get through his points, sir, so he doesn't have to rush. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Right now, PacifiCorp is planning on operating at least 15 of its coal plants into the 2040 timeframe. And the details of that are in my journal article. So I think that's, you know, this is not just wordsmithing in the document. This is huge. This is fundamental. It's the footing that everything dealing with the electric sector rests on because of the passage of 1547. Moving on to the section 2030 objectives beginning on page 16. Item number one, building and energy on page 16. Mm-hmm. Goal is to use renewables to meet 50% of the energy used in all buildings with 10% produced in Multnomah County. That, there needs to be some clarification there. I don't want to take the time here to go into that. I would like to be able to work behind the scenes with appropriate staff. But I think the bottom line is that whatever we do with contracts and law and renewable energy certificates and so forth, that doesn't determine how electricity flows. The electricity flows like water. It goes to the path of least resistance. Physics determines electricity flows, not what we do institutionally. And that's really hard to keep separate, but it's crucial. So carbon price, so I'd say that, so there needs, because of what I just said, the building and energy goal on page 16, I don't know how that's going to be, I don't see how that's going to be met. carbon pricing, 1H on page 20, says it's in progress. I don't know where that progress is in the state of Oregon. There was a SB 1574 last year that died in committee, which was cap and trade, not carbon pricing. So I don't know anything that's been happening in this state anywhere on that issue. Quickly, the last thing, electricity supply, item 3A on page 22, also in progress, should be noted as only starting. Because of what I just said, 1547 did not require coal plant closures, and it does not require them to be phased out by 2025, as the plan currently says. And I already noted the fact that PacifiCorp is going to be running their coal plants, 15 out of about 30 coal plants, into the 2040s.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
And I've had some dialogue with Nathan, and I've tried to, I don't know how he and I could better connect on some of this stuff to see.
Yeah, we'd be happy to connect you. I can't see if Kristen is still hiding back there. Very good.
You could email to a speech, but also I think directly connecting.
Yeah, we've been emailing back and forth on face-to-face. I don't.
Right, the planning sustainability staff
very good.
As well.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Susan, could you come back up? Hello again, Commissioner Fish.
Yeah, two questions. One is, last year I sold my house, and you know we were dutifully doing composting along with all the other recycling that the city requires. I'm now in an apartment building, and there is no composting. And so the other day, my son and daughter said, "What's up with that?" And what is our thinking in terms of some kind of transition to the multifamily context?
I'll let Michael go. We've been working on it because the problem is there's no yard debris, and so the easy answer is it's messier. So we have to come up with a system, because now you know when you dump it in, the grass and everything else soaks it up, and there's this much food waste and there's this much yard debris. And so for an apartment building, it's not like that.
Yeah. So. Apartment buildings, multifamily properties, arrange their own garbage recycling, composting, collection. And so it's possible for the building manager to arrange to have the food scraps picked up. There are, I should know this number and I don't, but I think it's 100 and some multifamily properties that do have food scrap collection, but it is at the discretion of the property owner. We are working on this right now. One of the challenges with multifamily is that there are so many different building typologies, from the fiveplex that's not that different from single, you know, row houses, to the big tower. And you need a really different approach depending on the building typology. But our current regulations treat it all the same. And so we're trying to dig into, okay, we've got 100 and some properties who already do this. What can we learn about the ones who are doing it that will let us then standardize this for different building types? We're working on it.
So let me. So that makes perfect sense.
If you want to do it, well, we will be there to help your property manager set it up.
As always, you're one step ahead of us. So, Patty was mentioning to me the other day that we have a 13-year-old at home that needs a public service project, and actually, I thought this would be a very interesting thing for a young person in our building to investigate, and then kind of figure out what's possible and maybe present it to the landlord. So if you could point me to where on the website I can direct my son, and then he'll do some research. And my guess is that there are a lot of young people in the city that might be encouraged to work on sort of thinking about how their building could participate and along the way learn something about the Climate Action Plan. Voluntarily or involuntarily learn about it. But I think Patty thinks this would be a good learning experience for our son. And the second thing I wanted to ask you is, now that I live in a very dense urban area in Goose Hollow, I'm more aware of the leaf blowers, particularly because they operate all at odd hours and they're incredibly noisy. And my recollection is once upon a time you said that they're also big polluters. Where do we stand with these gas-powered leaf blowers and in the context of our climate action plan?
So leaf blowers are big polluters in terms of air pollution. So in terms of public health impacts, they're not big polluters in terms of carbon dioxide emissions. So from a climate action plan perspective, it's not something that's going to feature prominently. From a public health, air quality, and also nuisance perspective, there's certainly an opportunity. We looked into this some years ago, and I'm trying to recall where it led us.
Could you send me whatever you had, Ben?
I will see what I can find.
Because the three things that jump out at me is, one is people use them at all hours, and when they're outside of the normal hours that you're allowed to make noise, they're really noisy. I mean, they're shockingly noisy, and they reverberate off all the windows. Number two, they're very inefficient. I mean, I have people, neighbors, who use them to like to move three leaves that are actually pinned down because they're in water. And it's like, really, this is why we need this piece of equipment? And three, if as you say, they're big polluters, I wonder whether at some point we consider whether they're necessary in our city.
They're truly one of the worst inventions ever. It was sort of the 80s version of the cell phone, just something that never should have happened to modern society. And you didn't even, that was a good rant, but you forgot the one where you have one set of people blowing the leaves this way, and then a completely different set of people blowing the leaves back. And then it just sort of, it's the same pile of leaves all fall going back and forth. And Leah's not speaking up yet, but eventually it just gets dumped in the street for her to pick up anyway.
Well, my favorite is my wife and I get coffee around the corner from where we live every morning, and there's a guy who works in this complex who comes out with a leaf blower and blows us while we're sitting there. Blows the wind. And so what happens is you get this dust storm of dirt and other debris, and it's like, is this really necessary? Anyway, I'd like to know more about it.
And with that, quickly turning to Commissioner Udaly on a different subject, no doubt.
Well, I have a few questions.
The first one is, I know Audubon Society expressed some concerns about our conversion to LED lights and the particular type of light we chose in combination with the non-recessed fixtures. So I'm wondering if, as we're moving forward, are we making different choices? And the concern was that the brightness could potentially impact animal, plant, and human life or health.
So I can, I'll get you some more detailed follow-up information, but we have received a lot of inquiries and complaints and concern over the LED conversions because they are brighter.
Yeah.
They are pointed more directionally down. There's actually less light going up, but they are so bright pointing down that they are perceived as causing light pollution.
Yes.
But I would be, and so we're not looking at changing the types of bulbs and that we're using, no.
Okay.
And we have also can go out, just FYI, if people complain and don't like, if it's too bright for their neighborhood, we can go out and make adjustments and dim them as well, and we have done that too.
Okay.
But I will send you some more follow-up detailed
information.
Good to know.
Thank you.
Yep.
Second question is, are we considering property assessed clean energy options for homeowners? Low and moderate income homeowners who may not be able to access conventional bank loans and would like to make those clean energy improvements to their homes?
Yeah, right. So currently we are not allowed to do that on the statewide we are not allowed to do residential because of statewide law right now and federal law. But what it came out maybe 8 years ago is that we started with residential, and that's how we developed Clean Energy Works, which is now in Habit, which was we wanted to come up with a financing tool that would allow people to put no money down, be able to finance their home improvements, and pay it back over time with the energy savings. So we started that as part of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, realized 2 years in that it would be able to run quicker, faster, smoother if we made it a nonprofit. So we set it up as a nonprofit and spun it off out of the city. So those tools are available. It's never easy for any low-income person to want to enter into any kind of loan arrangement mm-hmm. and inhabit. I mean, it doesn't. It may not be called a loan, but it walks and talks like a loan, just like anything else. And so having to put that money up, being able to get that money, and then being able to have an arrangement where then the rest of the loan can go with the house when it's sold is a great idea. We found that we targeted low-income families in our first